Hello, I'm Terrence McNally, and welcome to Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work. I'll be speaking today with Michael Brune, Executive Director of the Sierra Club, the nation's largest grassroots environmental organization with 3 million members and supporters. And you can learn more at Sierra Club, one word, sierraclub.org. Now, I've been doing these conversations since the mid-90s when I took a hiatus in 2014, but after Trump's Electoral College victory, I felt I had to get back on, deal with the causes, the repercussion, the response. And this is the 32nd such interview, Paul Hawken on climate change, Naomi Klein on No Is Not Enough, David K. Johnston on the daily dirty work of the Trump administration. The show streams weekly on the Progressive Voices Network on TuneIn. Podcasts are available anytime, anywhere on iTunes, Podomatic, and at my site, terrencemcnally.net. Now, a quick plug for participation. Let me offer you a few websites with information on how to confront the Trump agenda and work toward the healthy and just future we all need. Probably the largest organization working for that is Indivisible Guide, indivisibleguide.com. It's now with at least 5,000 local groups organized into a national coalition. Our Revolution, one word, ourrevolution.com, which is the group that grew out of the Bernie Sanders campaign. MoveOn.org, a longtime digital activist organization now working more closely with grassroots, MoveOn.org, and a California digital organization also working more closely these days with the grassroots Courage Campaign, one word, CourageCampaign.org, and two very specific ones, Five Calls, that's the number five, and then Calls, FiveCalls.org, which gives you the timely calls you might make to your representatives because of issues that are up, legislation that's happening, and townhallproject.com. One word, townhallproject, which tells you when your representatives or nearby representatives are going to be holding town halls for you to attend and let your feelings be known. You can email me at temcnally@mac.com if you want more info about any of all of this. Now, to today's guest. Let me note a couple of recent news stories. First, according to a new statewide assessment released Monday by the California Natural Resources Agency, heat waves will grow more severe and persistent, shortening the lives of thousands of Californians. Wildfires will burn more of the state's forests. The ocean will rise higher and faster, exposing California to billions in damage along the coast. And on the other hand, last week, the Trump administration offers up its revision to former President Obama's Clean Power Plan, the keystone of U.S. climate policy, where the Obama plan aimed to cut U.S. greenhouse gas emissions from the electricity sector by 32% compared to 2005 levels by 2030. The Trump plan would reduce those numbers a measly 0.7 to 1.5%. During that same time frame. And by allowing states to set their own rules for regulating power plants or request permission to opt out altogether, the administration's own EPA estimates the Trump plan will lead to as many as 1,400 additional premature deaths a year from increased emissions of the fine particulate matter produced by coal burning, which are linked to heart and lung disease, plus as many as 15,000 new cases of upper respiratory problems, a rise in bronchitis, tens of thousands of missed school and work days. But let me add a third piece of news. Saturday, September 8th, there'll be a global day of action, Rise Up for Climate. With those headlines in mind, and the 2018 midterms less than 70 days away, my guest today is Executive Director of America's largest grassroots environmental group, the Sierra Club. Mike Brune's first environmental job was as an organizer for Greenpeace. In 1998, he joined Rainforest Action Network, where he ultimately served for 7 years as executive director, leaving in 2010 to take the same role at Sierra Club. He's also the author of Coming Clean, Breaking America's Addiction to Oil and Coal. Welcome, Michael Brune, to Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work.
Hey, Terrence. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, you're very welcome. And let me tell listeners, we're recording this conversation Wednesday, October 29th, 2018. Now, I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the ideas and the work that we talk about. So I cited a few highlights, but can you, in your own words, tell us about how you see your path to the work that you do today? And feel free to mention mentors, turning points, moments of decision, that sort of thing.
All right, sure. Let's see. Well, I grew up in the New Jersey Shore, Chadwick Beach, New Jersey, which is near Toms River, New Jersey. And My mother was a public school teacher. My father worked in construction and was also the mayor of Toms River Township in New Jersey when I was a kid growing up. I have two older sisters, younger brother, and they're all doing good deeds. You know, they're one is a speech therapist, the other one works on child and maternal health care issues. My brother is a social worker. And so growing up, I remember vividly my father running political campaigns to get on the township committee and then eventually was the mayor. My mom talking about justice and the world, whether it's economic justice issues or racial or environmental issues. And then when I was a teenager, early teenager, growing up in New Jersey, we had these horrific water pollution challenges, both with Barnegat Bay, where I lived, but particularly the ocean. And the causes of the pollution were, there's a couple main sources. One was the fact that hospitals in the New York, New Jersey, Connecticut area were allowed to dump their hospital waste straight into the ocean without any controls, pollution controls, or permits, or any mechanism to reduce the waste or mitigate what was being dumped. And so, literally, I'd be out body surfing or playing on the beach with my friends and family, and these hypodermic needles would be washing up on shore. The other problem was that there was a chemical company that was operating in Toms River itself, and it had a pipeline that went straight underneath the town and went straight out into the ocean. This is a town that now has these cancer clusters, these devastating cancer clusters that have been plaguing families for now a couple decades. But this chemical company, Toms River Chemical, which was part of a multinational corporation called Ciba Geigy, had one of the only, if not the only, permit to dump its chemical sludge, its chemical waste, straight into the ocean. And I remember vividly coming out of the ocean, sometimes with a rash, sometimes just not feeling well, and the fact that beaches were closed, sometimes for a few days, sometimes for weeks on end, and seeing both, you know, how frustrating and disappointing and sickening this was, literally, but also the impact on the local economy. I saw it, our family felt it personally with my dad's construction business. So what happened as I was kind of coming of age, as I was being coming into being a teenager, is I saw how there were these local community groups that started to organize against these both sources of pollution. And then I saw how they were effective. Eventually, we got a ban on hospital waste dumping off the coast of New Jersey, which was something that we shouldn't have had to fight for. And then eventually, Toms River Chemical shut down, closed the loop in their facility, stopped dumping waste into the ocean, and changed their practices pretty significantly after far too many years of delays and dumping. And so I became inspired to see how a few organizers and then a few hundred active citizens could make a very powerful and profound and measurable difference in my own life and in the place where I lived. And so I became inspired, and, you know, with the context of growing up in a family that talked about the world and talked about what was happening and what we could do to have an impact on the world, to then see this really great case study was a very powerful thing. And it's pretty much shaped a lot of what I do and how I do it ever since.
And I read in, I think, a bio of yours, Mike, that there was a trip to California that you found inspiring as well.
Yeah. So I grew up in New Jersey. We went in the outdoors all the time. Of course, I was hanging out by the beach and playing by the beach as much as I could, but my family liked to camp. But, you know, when you grow up on the East Coast, it's there's not that much dramatic variety in terms, we would go down to Maryland or out to Pennsylvania, maybe up into New England. It was beautiful. I loved it. And then when I was just before I turned 14, we took a big family road trip out to California. I think it was the first time I'd ever been on a plane, maybe the second time I'd ever been on a plane.
Uh-huh.
Flew out to Los Angeles, and we did like the classic American road trip through the national parks. We went from L.A., we went out to the Grand Canyon, Zion, Bryce, Yosemite, went up to Lake Tahoe, came through San Francisco. And I remember specifically driving from L.A. to the Grand Canyon, through the Mojave Desert, kind of having my mind blown. And then, like, millions of people, tens of millions of people, went to the Grand Canyon. And I remember standing on the edge and realizing that there was no way I was going to spend the rest of my life in New Jersey. And much to my parents' chagrin. And
yes.
My wife and I moved out in 1995 to San Francisco, and we've been in the Bay Area ever since.
Yeah, I must say I grew up on the East Coast myself, and most of my younger life in Florida, where the biggest hill is about 350 feet or something. And I do remember the first time I also came to California, and it was just such a revelation that the land and the ocean could just be as impressive as it was. And you went to work originally for Greenpeace and then for Rainforest Action Network. And I remember, I think that's when I met you first, was when you were still at RAN. That was a fairly small organization that had a pretty significant impact.
Yeah, Rainforest Action Network was and is just a great organization. It's fairly lean, when you compare it to some other organizations and institutions, but it gets a lot done. I think in part because it has a very clear purpose. When I was there, we were really clear about what we did and what we didn't do. At RAN, we really didn't work on legislation. Lots of great groups do that, whether it was at the state or federal or even international level. Our focus was on corporate campaigns, trying to inspire or cajole or push companies to do the right thing. And we were focused, of course, on forest protection and supporting the rights of indigenous inhabitants of forests. And we realized that companies like FedEx, we used to be called Kinko's, or Home Depot and Lowe's, these massive buyers of both wood and paper, were pretty quietly playing a powerful role in deforestation, whether that was temperate rainforest in British Columbia, Pacific Northwest in British Columbia, or whether it was tropical rainforest in Southeast Asia or South America or even in Central Africa. So what we would do at RAN is we would mount these efforts to try to change these practices. Basically, we had the idea that if it's true that the customer is always right, then maybe we could inspire these big companies, the largest consumers of wood and paper in the world, to work with us to convince the logging companies themselves to stay out of intact forests and to promote more responsible, more sustainable logging practices where they did log. And it worked. Sometimes we sent one single letter to FedEx asking them to work with us to sign and develop policies to change logging practices to their suppliers, and they agreed.
Wow.
One of the first things I did, and I couldn't believe it. And then, with Home Depot, they didn't agree. And so we coordinated hundreds and hundreds of demonstrations and took out ads and papers and got a bunch of celebrities to get involved and shareholder action and civil disobedience and all of this stuff. And eventually Home Depot, to their credit, listened and they responded. And they also agreed to work with us. And as a result, we were able to protect millions of acres of intact, temperate rainforest and really to work with Native communities to make sure that the place in which they lived and have been for hundreds of years, oftentimes, weren't being destroyed.
Very good.
So it was and is a truly fantastic organization.
Yeah, no, I remember those particular actions and those particular initiatives. Let's talk now. In 2010, you moved to the Sierra Club. The Sierra Club, I would say, unlike Rainforest Action Network, isn't quite as narrowly focused. The Sierra Club, in a way, has two or three robust sort of purposes, it seems to me. Let me just read the mission, and then I want you to tell me about the history of the Sierra Club and how it pursues its goals today. The mission is to explore, enjoy, and protect the wild places of the earth, to practice and promote the responsible use of the earth's ecosystems and resources, to educate and enlist humanity to protect and restore the quality of the natural and human environment, and to use all lawful means to carry out these objectives. Can you flesh that out for us and lay in some history?
Sure. Well, I'll start with the beginning. To explore, enjoy, and protect the planet. That really sums up what we do pretty succinctly. The explore and enjoy part is a pretty vital part of the Sierra Club, I would say emotionally as well as strategically. We are, and we strive to be, and we really emphasize the joy, the part of what we do, the wonder of nature. You know, I think a lot of environmental organizations or a lot of environmental work, a lot of social change work is based on stopping really bad things from happening, rightfully so. And particularly for environmental issues, particularly on climate change, that can get pretty dark and pretty dour and depressing fairly quickly. If you're talking about wildfires or extreme weather events or the displacement of millions of people, life-threatening water shortages, all of these things that we're seeing, the depletion of species, the extinction of species, the impacts of health pollution on all of us, but particularly the most vulnerable and the poorest people among us, these are issues that are real, they are devastating, and yet, at the same time, we are lucky to be able to be alive on a beautiful, wondrous planet with so many things to explore and to enjoy. And so the Sierra Club, we actually got started as, today you'd call it like an adventure club, a hiking organization, an institution that got started by John Muir as a club, literally a club, to take people from the San Francisco Bay Area up to the Sierras, into Yosemite Valley and other places, simply to say, this is awesome. Let's go check it out. Let's go spend some time there. And eventually, it didn't take too long. And, of course, behind the idea of getting out into these wonderful places is, let's also work to protect them.
Mm-hmm.
So we have now been around for 126 years. I haven't been around for 126 years. Sometimes it feels like it, but Sierra Club's been around for 126 years, and we, of course, have evolved. We continue to do these outings, whether it's a two-hour hike in the Redwoods or around a lake or a 10-day hike in the Himalayas. We do literally thousands of outings locally, big national and international outings every year. And we have become a premier advocacy, grassroots advocacy organization, working to replace every single coal and natural gas plant in the country with 100% clean energy. We're working to stop any single build-out of fossil fuel infrastructure across the country and, again, transition to 100% clean energy. We're working to protect wild places and wildlife and, of course, promote and advocate for clean air and pure water at the same time.
Yeah, and in terms of the outings, I mean, I'm a member in Southern California, and it's not just, you know, when you've got to take a day and get off somewhere, it's even, you know, an evening hike, a sunset hike. It's very local. And I have, I remember one of my neighbors, single gentleman in his 70s, that was his sort of group of friends, was the folks that he hiked with Thursday evenings through Sierra Club.
Yeah, you know, it's one of the most beautiful things about this organization. I remember last year I went to the 50th anniversary of our chapter in Michigan, and I gave a keynote address. We had both of the state's senators that were there to also give keynote addresses, and we gave these big speeches, big room of, you know, maybe 400, 500 people. And honestly, like, I wasn't the focus of the night. Neither were these two U.S. senators. They weren't the focus of the night. Really, it was a reunion. We had people who were getting up and saying, I've been married for 48 years, and I met my wife at the first Sierra Club gathering years and years ago. And we had people, lots of people who met, got married, had kids, now have grandkids. It's similar to, obviously it's different, but it's similar to the relationships that people develop at a church or at a Little League field. It becomes, the Sierra Club is unique, I think, among most environmental or most other organizations in that we really do make room and have space for volunteers for people. And what we find as a result is that the Sierra Club is a big part of people's lives, socially, culturally. It's how they spend their time, both to have fun and to make a difference in the world. And it's a you know, I feel like it's a privilege and a great thing to be a part of.
Very good, Mike. That's Mike Bruin, executive director of the Sierra Club. Now, I assume most listeners know the Trump administration is probably the worst for nature and public health, at least since the EPA was created in 1970. But let's keep up the theme we're doing, Mike, which is start with some good news. Underneath the headlines, and I'm not necessarily talking about the last, 18 months or 2 years, but over, say, the last decade, an awful lot of progress has been made. Can you talk a little bit about some of the good news?
Yeah, I can talk for a long time about good news. I can also talk about the bad news.
And we'll get to that.
But, and it's not really just with a long time horizon since EPA was created over the last decade. There's a lot of good news to celebrate even under this administration.
Very good.
But looking a little bit more broadly, I think when it comes to climate and energy issues, what I find to be most encouraging is to note and to see the changes that have happened in the electric sector, in the power sector, how we get our electricity across the country. If you look back to the beginning of the Bush administration, George W. Bush, we, as a country, we were facing proposals to build at least, the administration proposed to build 150 new coal-fired power plants all across the country. And after that proposal came out with through the Cheney Energy Task Force, then we saw utilities across the country add on to that. So in reality, we were facing about 200, a little bit more than 200 new coal-fired power plants. Coal plants are pretty expensive to build and pretty expensive to operate. So the idea was that these plants would be operating 24/7, 365 days out of the year for about 50 years. So we would have locked in coal as the dominant source of electricity production for another 50 years, which would have been game over for climate change, would have had really no shot at even stabilizing the climate pollution that is emitted in the U.S. each year, much less reducing it at the scale and pace of what we need. So coal, of course, is the dirtiest form of energy. It contributes to 4 out of the 5 leading causes of death in this country. It is deadly and dangerous all the way from the mining of coal, the transportation of coal, burning of coal, even storing the coal ash is highly toxic, whether it seeps into the water supply or the impact on air quality. So the good news is that very quietly, and it started pretty slowly, as these first new coal plants were being proposed, a lot of the first ones were being proposed in the upper Midwest, kind of this string of states from, let's say, western Pennsylvania all the way through to Minnesota. There were Sierra Club local groups and chapters and other organizations, really small grassroots organizations, that started to organize and to say, we really don't want a new coal plant in our backyard with a gigantic smokestack that's next to a school or next to a playground or next to a park or right in the middle of town. We don't want to be breathing dirty air for the next half century. And so they began to organize. One of the first places we organized was about 50 miles south of Chicago. We had one staff person at the Sierra Club working on it at the time, and this person had never bought a coal plant, had no experience, didn't even really know much about the industry, but had a great work ethic and built a great network of folks. We stopped that coal plant. Then we stopped about 30 coal plants in the entire region from being built. And you fast forward a few years, we had hundreds of organizations that would come together every winter, map out which coal plants were being proposed, studying the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act. We had boot camps, literally of dozens of lawyers coming together and figuring out how to use the law to stop these plants from being built. We had organizers coming together from across different organizations to figure out how do you build a constituency to stop these plants from being built. And of those 200 coal plants, about 180, 185 of those plants were never built to begin with. Since then, just to finish the story, we've mapped out every single existing coal plant in the U.S. to say, how do we retire all of them? How do we make sure that we don't have any coal being built in this country or being burned in this country today? How do we transition to clean energy, clean renewable energy, and make sure we're taking care of workers and communities in the process? Right now, we are about halfway to our goal, about 270 coal plants of an original 530 have either been retired or are on a pace to be retired within the next several years. And for most of them, we're going to be able to transition away from coal, not rely on natural gas, and go all the way to clean, renewable energy instead. So that is awesome news both for the climate, but for me, it shows that we're pretty powerful as a country. We have powerful grassroots energy that is moving away from fossil fuels, all kinds of fossil fuels and dirty fuels, to clean energy, and it is working. It's working for the communities. It's working for the environment, for clean air, clean water, and we're seeing clean energy now is cheaper than fossil fuels, and particularly cheaper than coal and gas and nuclear power.
Right. Now, let's tease out a few things from that. One is, first of all, my guess is most listeners didn't know that, and it is interesting how, you know, again, there's a natural tendency for bad news to get more publicity than good news. But one of the other things I see is that while national policy is a certain particular kind of challenge to change, most of this action was local, correct?
Yes. And national action was also needed. So that's why we need people to be active locally, and we really do have to pay attention to all these national rules. So specifically, the way in which a lot of these plants were not built, or the way in which a lot of the existing plants are being retired, is because what we would see happen from the federal level is that the EPA, under Lisa Jackson, and then Gina McCarthy under the Obama administration, would look at the different pollution control technologies and say, we can use new technology to start to control pollution coming from coal plants. And so they set higher standards against mercury and arsenic and dioxins and the sludge coming through with coal ash or the soot, the smog coming from coal plants. Then, so that would happen at the national level. These are all the rules, of course, that Trump is trying to undermine and gut and change or not enforce. Mm-hmm. But once those standards were in place, then the local work was vital. And whether it was at the state level or more often than that, at the very local level, local communities would say, we got to get this plant out of here. We don't need to be breathing dirty air, particularly when a combination of solar and wind and energy efficiency and storage will keep the lights on, very well could save us money and make sure that we have local jobs in our community at the same time. So really that local work, the local organizing, paying attention to what's happening in your own backyard is vital, and the federal piece is important too. One quick note, a little bit of good news that's much more current.
Yes.
Is that under the Obama administration, we were basically, as a country, and what the Sierra Club was prioritizing was retiring coal plants, and we were basically able to retire a coal plant once every between 16 and 17 days.
Okay, twice a month.
All across the country.
Yeah.
Now, under Trump, with all that we're seeing coming from Trump's EPA and across the administration, we're retiring a coal plant across the country once every 16 or 17 days.
Ah, hasn't changed. That was going to be my question, actually, which is, as they attempt to relax rules, as they actually relax rules, is the campaign still succeeding? And you're saying, yes, it is.
Yes, it is most definitely succeeding. We are still retiring coal plants. We're beginning to retire gas plants and successfully defeat new gas plant proposals. We're seeing clean energy come in cheaper. So, yes, we are definitely continuing to have success. We've got a lot of momentum. And what is also true is that these fights are hard, and the assaults coming from EPA are coming from every direction. And the Sierra Club, Earth Justice, NRDC, the Environmental Integrity Project, CBD, lots of organizations are fighting as hard as we can in courts to prevent the Trump administration from rolling back these standards, gutting these standards, not enforcing these standards. And so it is we've had success, and it is still an open question about whether or not we can continue to see the same pace and the same rate of success over the coming months and years.
Right. I can imagine some of the success we've had so far has been because things were already moving. There was a momentum in particular cases and so on. And now with the new rulings, with the new lack of enforcement and so on, is that going to tamp down? Another question I have is, of course, the problem that we see in closing coal plants, coal mines, and so on is what happens to those workers. What has been the most successful means of transitioning workers and communities in that regard?
Well, so the way that we look at it is we divide it roughly into two different types of jobs. One is mining, and the other one is in the electric sector itself, at power plants. For workers who are working at utilities, whether it's coal plants or gas plants or nuclear power plants, a lot of those jobs, not all, but a lot of those jobs are unionized. And the decision to close a coal plant or the implementation of a decision to close a coal plant is one that typically happens over several years, in some cases 8-10 years down the road, in some cases 8-10 months down the road. If the coal plant closure happens because of legislation that we were able to pass or because of litigation and a settlement agreement that we were able to secure, we push really hard to make sure that there is a transition plan for workers who are working at that facility. And we've had plenty of success. There's a coal plant in Ohio that closed. There was a transition plan for workers and a new large solar farm that was established that hired workers who were returning vets coming from Iraq. A coal plant in Centralia, Washington, passed through legislation And we've been able to, secure a transition plan for workers up there as well. So for people who work at power plants, it's a challenge, to be sure. With each plant, we've prioritized wanting to do what we can to make sure that those workers are taken care of. It generally is a little bit easier because we have the legislation, because we have settlement agreements, and because there's time to plan. The workers either can get early retirement or maybe they can be transferred to another power plant, et cetera. For coal miners, it's been more difficult and a lot less successful, to be honest. We have found that lots of mines have been shuttered across the country, and elected officials, they're not paying attention to the problem really much at all. We find that most elected people, whether they're U.S. senators or state legislators, they're pounding their chest saying, we're gonna bring coal back, and are largely, not entirely, but largely ignoring the robust transition plan, economic transition plan that has to happen in Appalachia or in Wyoming or down in Texas or Utah or Colorado even, where coal is being produced. We need a lot more leadership from both parties. A lot more leadership is needed in the Republican Party, but even the Democratic Party needs to step up and advocate more forcefully, more aggressively, with a bigger and better vision for how to take care of workers and communities, because in the coal mining industry, that is the industry that is hurt the most. Those jobs, they're really not coming back. Maybe they'll, mine, they can get an extra shift here and there, but this is an industry that is not going to recover, and we have to help make sure that the workers in those industries have a foot and a leg in the clean energy future that's emerging.
Very good. Let me tell you again, this is Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with Michael Brune, Executive Director of the Sierra Club, the nation's largest grassroots environmental organization, 3 million members and supporters. And you can learn more at sierraclub.org. And want to mention that Saturday, September 8th, will be a global day of action in support of successfully confronting climate change. Rise for Climate is going to be demonstrations, marches all over the country. And to learn about what's going on in your area, you can go to riseforclimateoneword.org. Okay, let's go to, I don't want to spend, we could spend hours on what's also gone wrong since Trump came in. But again, everyone knows that the daily tweets, the daily arguments, the daily outrages sort of focus our attention. But for those people who haven't noticed, the two things that I think the Trump administration has been most successful at, to the negative repercussions for the country, are packing the courts with judges and rolling back environmental regulations and environmental policy. So a bit of a list here of what's been going on behind the glare and what's been going on in terms of clean water, clean air, et cetera.
Sure. How much time do we have? There's a lot. And basically, to help your listeners understand this, the what has happened is that the administration has tried to roll back lots of regulations and safeguards and standards, or has started to roll back all of these standards. And the reason for that is that most of the progress that's happened at the federal level has been happening through executive or administrative action coming from EPA or the Energy Department or the Interior Department, and not through legislation. So Obama used the power of the presidency and the executive office to achieve a lot, to set a lot of progress, make a lot of progress possible at the local level. And so since it didn't happen legislatively, this administration is able to try to unwind that. So the list is pretty long. The Clean Power Plan is probably the most recent attempt to undo what Obama did, which is, as you said at the top of the show, what they're trying to do is relax the standards that have been set nationally and at the state level, and allow states to basically set whatever standard they would like for power plants, coal plants, and gas plants all across the country. We are challenging that in court, and we're going to win. There's just no way that this is going to be able to be upheld, and we're going to continue to make progress at the local level. Another big standard that really matters for California is the clean car standard. Mm-hmm. The administration is trying to undermine that as well. The clean car standard is like one of the best American success stories in the country, because not only will it save literally hundreds of millions and eventually billions of barrels of oil, and not only will it cut air pollution and water pollution and generally have a big impact on helping us solve climate change, but it saves consumers money, it reduces oil imports, and it also happened to save the U.S. auto industry when it was first put together a decade ago. So, of course, Trump is against it, and of course they're trying to undermine it, and of course they're trying to take away California's waiver that allows it to set really high standards.
Let me cut in for a second, Mike. For people who don't know about that particular set of rules there, the California waiver, what we're saying is there are national rules, but California has had a waiver for decades to set its own rules. And because of how huge the market for cars is in California, basically car companies don't want to create a car for California and a car for the rest, or a truck for the rest of the country. So the California standard becomes adopted by many other states and basically adopted by the car companies. Tell us where that stands right now.
Well, it's only been proposed by EPA, and so they're seeking public comment. Really, they're not. It's just what they have to go through. They don't really care. They don't give a damn about what the public has to say. This is a giveaway to major polluters. But the way the law is written, they're seeking public comment, and then they'll come out with a final proposal probably sometime next year, and then we will be challenging it in court. And making sure that they're not allowed to do this. There have been lots of attempts by this administration to go after the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, to expand offshore drilling, to try to have the Department of Energy bail out the coal industry. There have been attacks on science. There have been cuts to EPA. This administration has proposed to gut National Monuments, Bears Ears National Monument, and Grand Staircase Escalante, two of the most amazing places in the country, in Utah. All of these things, literally every one, is being challenged in court, and we haven't lost a major case yet. And so we and many others are fighting this in court, and then also fighting at the local level to make sure that they're the resistance to each of these measures is strong, and that we're able to both win politically and win in the long term.
If a listener, hears what you're saying and realizes, okay, this fight is going to take place in courts, if you will, in addition to Sierra Club, what other organizations should they sort of be paying attention to find out how they can stay up to speed and maybe contribute?
Well, first, thanks. There's lots of ways to get involved, but if you're interested in litigation, if you really want to both track these fights in court, contribute to them, or even just learn about them, Sierra Club we have a large team of lawyers, some of the most experienced and talented lawyers in the country. Earth Justice is one of our closest partners. They've got brilliant leadership and some of the, again, most committed, hardworking attorneys in the country. I really like the Environmental Integrity Project. Eric Schaefer runs that, former EPA lawyer. They do fantastic work. NRDC has a great team of lawyers with whom we work pretty closely. They're doing good stuff.
Okay.
I guess, there's plenty of organizations.
Yeah, that gives people. Environmental Integrity is one I haven't heard of, and I've been involved in this field for years. Tell me just a little bit about them.
Yes, sure. So run by Eric Schaefer. He, as I mentioned, came from EPA. They do great work. They probably don't have as big of a brand name as some other groups, but we work with them all the time on against mountaintop removal to protect water quality. We work a lot with them on coal plants, individual coal plant fights.
Okay, environmental integrity, and that's they're primarily a legal arm?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Not exclusively, but primarily, yeah.
Okay, one of the things you said is that one of the ways that Trump has been able to, I mean, if we look at it, congressionally, they haven't been very successful. So it's in, as I said, it's in judges and regulations that they're most successful, because that can be done, as you said, by executive order. So my question is, if the Republicans lose control of at least the House in 2018, and if Trump is defeated in 2020, how easy will it be, given the method they've used to change the law, how easy will it be to restore? How much damage, if they're in power for, you know, 2-4 years, how much damage can be done? How easily can it be restored?
I would never use the word easy to restore what's been damaged.
I'm sorry. Yes,
but it can be done. Part of what will make the rebuilding effort so difficult and lengthy has been that not only are they going after almost every single safeguard environmentally that is on the books, and I'm not even exaggerating, it's almost every single one that we can think of that has any consequence, but they are gutting staff, they are muzzling scientists, pushing them out of the agencies, and we've read about all this, but
right.
they're decimating the ability of talented, hardworking, underpaid professionals to do their jobs. And you can't just flick a switch and turn that back on again. People are being driven out of EPA, Department of Energy, Interior, and it'll take time to rebuild that kind of protection.
So what I get is that a signature on an executive order can change a rule, but the actual human power, the brain power, the energy and so on that it takes to do a good job of protecting the environment and transitioning to a different future, that's what you can't do with a signature.
That's right. That's
yeah.
Right.
Let me just ask about a couple of other issues in terms of whether the Sierra Club's involved in them or what they're doing. One is divestment from fossil fuels. How is that? Is that a movement Sierra is involved in at all? And if not, just what's your assessment of progress in that arena?
Yeah, sure. We're not the lead organization, but we definitely are involved. We've had a lot of our student activists doing divestment work at college campuses. We do some work at the state level with teachers, pension funds, and retirement funds, things like that. It's another part of the whole ecosystem of advocacy. And we think it's really important, and it's having great success at helping to move dollars not just away from fossil fuels, but helping an increase in investment in the solutions that we want to see.
Okay, and how about the confrontation with fracking? In other words, a few years ago, one of the sort of memes that you heard was that natural gas would allow us to get off of dirtier fuels and maybe become more energy independent and so on. And it really did restore the fossil fuel industry in America for a while. What is the current status of fracking? By that, I'm asking two questions. What have we learned about the public health effects and the environmental effects of fracking, and what is going on in terms of slowing it down, curtailing it?
Sure. Yeah, thanks for bringing it up. So fracking is dangerous, and the impacts on air and water quality, particularly water quality, are huge. There are plenty of studies by Duke University, Cornell, and many others showing how pervasive the impacts, particularly on water quality, are and the risks that are posed by fracking.
Oh, and let's tell people who don't know what fracking is.
What fracking is it's relatively new form of drilling for oil that has opened up new, previously inaccessible, inaccessible oil and gas fields across the country. And so it has allowed for a significant, a dramatic expansion of oil and particularly gas drilling in parts of the country that had never seen it before, in Pennsylvania, throughout Ohio, into Appalachia, way down in Texas, and fracking here a little bit in California as well. A lot of the fracking, not all, but a lot of the fracking is for natural gas. And what we have learned as a country and as a community over the last decade or more is that because of fracking, because of the leaking from pipes and transmission, the impact of gas from a climate perspective is horrific, and it's a major accelerator of climate change globally. And so all of the activism that we're seeing against fracking is desperately needed. And whether it's in California to push Governor Brown to start to curtail fracking within the state or any kind of drilling in the state, or whether it's happening around the world, we're seeing bans against fracking. We're seeing, in the absence of bans, which are really needed, we're seeing at least larger set-asides, so 2,500 feet or more, little exclusion zones where fracking can't take place in forests or parks or near schools and other homes and businesses. And that's coupled, of course, with an emphasis on clean energy, which is the other part of the equation. We can't just say what we're opposed to. We have to say what we're in favor of. And on that, we've seen great progress, particularly here in California.
Yeah, no, I mean, I in preparing for this, the statistics on clean energy and the price of clean energy, you can, anyone who's interested and hasn't looked into that recently, you know, go online, search for that. Things are better than you might know. Here's a quote. This is from Bloomberg, New Energy Finance. Renewable energy sources are set to represent almost three-quarters of the $10.2 trillion the world will invest in new power generating technology until 2040. I mean, three-quarters of the investment is going to be in renewables. And the reason is that the price... In late December 2017, RMI, Rocky Mountain Institute, announced that construction began on a 3-megawatt solar project in New Mexico that will set its power below 4.5 cents per kilowatt hour, the lowest reported contract for distributed photovoltaic solar energy across the entire U.S., beating coal prices that average 6 cents and up per kilowatt hour, 6 cents and up, and competing with natural gas. Averaging 4.2, so that is the big news. Let me turn. We've got the we've got a march on September 8th, and we've got elections November 6th. How does a grassroots group like Sierra Club pick their battles these days? Let me ask that. And what are your plans? And what are your plans for the midterms?
Yeah, sure. Very carefully. There are many battles to fight, so we have to pick the ones that are of greatest significance. We're in the end stages of a major battle here in California. Yesterday, the state assembly passed SB 100, which will require, when the governor signs it, will require the state to get all 100% of its energy sources from carbon-free sources by 2045. It basically changes the renewable portfolio standard, which currently wants us to get to 50% all the way up to 100%, which is awesome.
Yes.
So we're focusing intensely on the marches, both here in California on September 8th and across the country. And then for the midterms, the Sierra Club is, we are nonpartisan, and we are fiercely political in that we will do, we'll make 1,000 endorsements up and down the ticket in the midterms, and then mobilize our members, whether it's there's 14 seats that could be flipped to the Democrats in California. There's several dozen seats across the country where we could elect pro-environmental champions. There's 36, I believe, governor's races taking place across the country. But then there's a lot of mayoral races, city council races that are vital from an energy and climate and environmental perspective, because those local seats have the power to make big decisions about pipelines or power plants, or whether we're investing in wildlife protection at the local level. So we're doing a lot in the midterms between now and November.
So wherever you live, you may be able to find, as you suggested, endorsements up and down the ticket from national to local at sierraclub.org.
That's right. Thank you, Terrence.
Okay. And what... If a listener says, I've been sitting on the sidelines, I want to get involved, what would you recommend they do besides make sure that they check these endorsements and push for those elections?
Well, the first thing I would say is thanks. We need your help, and you have a role to play in fighting for the world that you believe in, and you have power, particularly when you find people like yourself who want to get engaged. The Sierra Club, we have a volunteer chapter in every state and local volunteer groups in almost every city in the country. So if you want to work with the Sierra Club and if you want to put some time in, whether it's an hour a week or 50 hours a week, you will find like-minded people just like yourself who have values that are pretty similar to yours, who want to make the world a better place and have fun doing it. And if the Sierra Club, you know, if it's not the right fit, there are plenty of organizations, many of which that you mentioned at the top of the show. Indivisible, that's doing great work on this election. Move On, that does fantastic work all the time. NAACP, fighting for civil rights and a big partner of the Sierra Club. There are a lot of ways to make a difference as a consumer, as a voter, as an activist, as a neighbor. And when you find a group that works for you, if you give it a little bit of time, you can find a place for yourself and you can find a community, and it's very rewarding. It's a beautiful thing to be a part of.
Yeah, right. In other words, it's not only just about the end, but when you find an organization that's working for something you believe in and with people that you share hearts and minds, that's the journey, and
yes,
the journey itself can be very rewarding. So, again, the website is sierraclub.org. Michael's book from, I think you had done it earlier and updated in 2010, is Coming Clean, Breaking America's Addiction to Oil and Coal. For information regarding September 8th, Global Day of Action, Rise Up for Climate, you can go to riseforclimate.org. For this conversation and many other interviews, articles, transcripts, and to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net, terrencemcnally.net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website. If you want to receive my weekly email announcement telling you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, and usually 7 or 8 very relevant and timely articles, you can sign up at my site, again, terrencemcnally.net, aworldthatjustmightwork.com, or email me at temcnally@mac.com, T-E-M-C-N-A-L-L-Y. You can also subscribe and listen to the Freeform podcast on iTunes. You can find years of podcasts at my site. Archives include Michael Lewis, Jeremy Scahill, Naomi Klein, Robert Reich, Van Jones, Connie Rice, across the board, people who are working to make this world a better place. You can follow me on Twitter at McNally-Terrence. Thanks to G, my engineer, and Mark Maxwell in production, George Vassilopoulos at Progressive Voices, and most of all, you, my listeners, please share this podcast widely. Thank you, Michael Broom. Keep up the good work.
Thanks, Terrence. Great talking with you.